I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Welcome to the Krishna Dass Pilgrim Heart Hour. This podcast is a manifestation of our interconnected lives, and we wish to keep it free at all costs, if you can say that. So, we are dependent on the generosity of you, our listeners. So, please go to mindpodnetwork.com/KD and either use the donate button or just bookmark the Amazon portal. We receive a small percentage of however much you pay for whatever you bought. Nothing extra for you, but a tangible contribution, if small, for us. You could also sign up for a free trial with the voluminous audible.com. We get something out of that, too. We thank you for the support and allowing us to continue presenting Krishna Dass's excellent talks.
Coming back to what you said earlier about the house and the walls, so obviously we're not the house, so we're not the body, so I can understand that, and probably now when you're 30 something or 40, none of the cells in your body are the same because they're renewing themselves, so physically you're not the same person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then when you have your photo album and you look back at photos, well, this is when I was 3 years old, this is when I was a baby, so mm-hmm. there's no physically you don't resemble that person anymore, but then you know that this is the same person, but physically it's not. So what is the same thing? And then it's different for every body, which then contradicts saying that mm-hmm. we're all one. And I'm struggling a bit with grasping that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. I mean, you made a nice statement, but what are you asking?
So what is this, what I'm recognizing, this is me. And going back and looking at when we're saying, actually, this is mm-hmm. all ego and it doesn't really exist. It's just the mind.
Let's not say it doesn't exist. I mean, that's a little bit extreme. There's relative reality and there's ultimate reality. In the relative world, you exist, right? You asked this question. You thought about it. You picked up the microphone. Somebody did that, right? So that person exists. But you know, things look a certain way to us. The world looks a certain way. We feel a certain way about ourselves. But, you know, if we were born, let's say we're kind of a being, and we were born at night, okay, at dark, when there was no sunlight, and we grew up within an hour, right? And we're fully grown, and we're walking around at night, and we see these shapes around us and stuff like that. And we think this is the way things are, right? We're looking around, we see the world a certain way. And then the sun starts to rise, and things look different. It's not that what we were seeing wasn't, that we weren't seeing what we were seeing. It's just that we weren't seeing the whole story. the things that you mentioned about seeing, remembering yourself as a child, and you know the body changes, but that you feel like you're the same person. There's still processes going on, and even that will change eventually. There is this thing they call death, which kind of changes the game a little bit at a certain point. So we're processing, we're still in process right now. What won't change is what's deeper than, is the awareness of all those things you mentioned. There's awareness, consciousness, and then there's all those different experiences. The experiences keep changing. The me even keeps changing. I mean, you might think of yourself one way at 3 years old, another way at 30. And you would never say, I'm the same. But inside, the awareness is always the same. What's looking out of your eyes never changes. How you interpret the things that your eyes see, that changes. But the seeing is the same. Hearing is the same. It might hear different things, but hearing is the same. The awareness is not changing, but all the experiences change. So these names come from the place of awareness. This is what God is, essentially. Sorry, I said that. I didn't mean to say that. But essentially, consciousness, truth, consciousness, and bliss are three of the qualities of this awareness. Sat, Chit, Ananda. That's what they say. So the deeper you go, the more you realize your experiences are conditioned by all kinds of things. And the more you can release yourself from those thoughts, you experience it differently. You can experience the changes in a different way. Thing is, you don't really need to know any of this. All you need to do is a practice. And that changes from the inside out. Ramakrishna didn't say, oh, you're going to feel this, you're going to feel that, you're going to feel this. You will feel many things. But you keep the practice going. And that's where you get the strength to release all the stuff, all the different experiences, and the identification with all that. Right now, we're in process. Birth, then we grow up, we get older, we get sick, and eventually we die. Right now, we haven't faced death yet, so we're not quite sure what that is. And what dies, we're not quite sure what that is. Me definitely dies. I doesn't die. Awareness doesn't die. Awareness is, you might say, the soul. And the soul then reincarnates, takes another suit of clothes to wear. I probably will not have t-shirts in my next life. No matter how hard I try. I could put them away in a drawer, lock them up, so they'll be there, you know, but I won't be there. So you just have to keep doing the practice, and everything you need to know comes from inside. The more you think about it, the more you think about it. And the less you are it. I mean, a certain amount of understanding is useful because it helps you, it reinforces your practice, it reinforces your understanding, and it gives you more faith that you're doing the right thing. But to try to figure it all out or understand it all up here, ain't going to happen. And if you think you figured it all out, that's when they put you away. Or you become a great guru and do bad things. It's better not to think, you know, you just can't know this stuff in the mind. Yeah, hi.
I just wondered if you could say something. I'm not necessarily asking about your personal experience, that's entirely up to you, but chanting the names is brilliant when we're feeling good, I find. And we can feel the joy and the bliss, and Hanuman leaping into my heart this morning is wonderful. You know, all this kind of stuff that you can experience or mm-hmm. thinking experience, when things are bad, when you're feeling down, from your experience, how do you keep that practice going when you're apparently not getting anything back?
Who
that
said,
makes
who,
sense.
Did Ramakrishna say anything about getting anything back? He
no.
said, he said plant the seeds, didn't he? So when this unhappiness, depression, difficult stuff happens in life, this is karma is coming to fruition. Just like when joy and good stuff comes, that's karma is coming to fruition. You like the good stuff and you yeah. don't like the hard stuff. Tough shit. What are you going to do? You better do the name when you, whenever you remember, which is why you have to do a practice every day, no matter how you feel. You think practice means feeling that way. It's much deeper than that. That's just more stuff. It's nice stuff. It's like jam on the toast. Sometimes you have to eat the toast dry with salt, which is what I had to do after I had hepatitis. No more jam, no more butter. It was still toast. So this is a perfect situation. You must practice regularly, especially when you don't want to, because otherwise you never get the strength to break the attachment to the negative things. And you only want the sweet things in life, but it's just not that way, is it? If a practice only was like that, what good would it be? If it didn't help you in the hard stuff. So you have to go deeper. So you have to do, I mean, you don't have to, believe me, but you might like to if you recognize that. Over time, from doing a practice regularly, regardless of how you feel, that's just, never mind. That's just stroking ourselves in a particular way that we like. But life doesn't always stroke us that way. But we can't stop living. So we have to keep remembering. That's the thing. Remember to repeat the name or to do your practice, whatever it is. Regardless of how you feel, that's when you'll experience the real strength of the practice and the power of the practice. But again, I'm not saying to sit down and push that stuff away. I didn't say push it away, and I didn't say hold on to the pleasant stuff. I simply said, repeat the name and remember to pay attention. As soon as you notice, oh, this is such a terrible day. I can't believe that guy did that to me. Once again, I picked another asshole who broke up with me. This is terrible. I'll be alone the rest of my life. This is going to be terrible. Right? It could be something like that. Keep singing. Keep remembering. You can't push that stuff away. If you push that stuff away, it just sticks to you. And if you hold on, try holding on to the joy. Obviously, that doesn't work either, right? You hold on, oh, I love this, Hanuman jumped into my heart. Wait a minute, he went right through and left the hole. It's all bullshit. Let it go. You know? You're here. Here is where all that stuff is happening. Right now. Always. Repeat the name, and when you notice you're gone, come back. That's all. You can always let go. That's the joy. That's the amazing part of it. Whatever you're stuck in, you can always let go if you have something to let go into, which is this practice or another practice. This, if we're developing the power to let go, not to just feel like this all the time. So, you know, like that. Everybody knows what that is. So that's when the real power of the practice comes. And that develops, that's a thing that you develop over time. So if you even just did 5 minutes a day where you turned the phone off and sat down or stood up or did whatever you do, but really tried to pay attention for just 5 miserable minutes a day, even if you're feeling like shit, that's a great time to practice. You'll see that 5 minutes, you won't be there for 1 second in that 5 minutes. For 5 minutes. And then time's up. Go away, do something else. But the effort you made in that 5 minutes, even though you were so unsuccessful, you might have thought, is has a huge effect over time. So cut yourself a break, give yourself some slack, relax a little bit, do the practice regularly, or whatever practice you do, regularly over time. And then you'll notice that these high experiences, they might be pleasant, but they come and go. You can't make them stay. So they must not be it, right? Because it doesn't come and go. It's who you are, who you'll always be. We don't come and go. We're always here. It's a good question.
Good answer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sorry.
It's okay. What are you sorry for? Don't be sorry. And, you know, the feeling you'll get over time of inner strength is so extraordinary. You know, but really it comes little by little. If it comes too fast, you just wind up clinging to it and causing more bullshit to yourself. So you just do the practice and then live your life. You know, don't try to make anything happen, and you'll see change over time. Guarantee. Don't hold me to it.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been working for a long time with kids.
Kids.
So I'm gonna. And lately I've been chanting, you know, just a chalisa with them sitting on my lap. Mm-hmm. Or. Yeah, actually, two things happen from my experience. Either they get very like boom, and they just sit like. And they listen, and we were very close. Mm-hmm. Or on a couple of occasions, they've exploded, you know, just running into the walls. Mm-hmm. And it feels very good to do it.
Same thing happens to me.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, do you have any experience with chanting with kids, or especially and Hanuman and kids and the Chalisa and kids. Is there anything you can share on that?
You know, people bring their babies to see me. Babies who have all their time through the womb have been hearing me sing on CD. And the moms bring their babies, like, and half the time when they hear my voice, they like jump on me and hold me and hug me, you know. The other half of the time, the kids go like, like this, and they start screaming and run away because they can't believe that the voice, this huge voice they've been hearing, you know, for all this time in the womb, is like actually in this body, and they freak completely, you know. So I don't, maybe that's something like that, you know. Kids are great that way. There's no, their bullshit detectors are very high, you know. If you try to quiet a kid down, they just look at you like you're out of your mind. No way I'm going to quiet down, asshole. You know? But if you're real, they respond to that. So it might have something to do with you wanting something from the kids, wanting them to quiet down. They can feel that. Or it might be just that's the way the energy hits them, you know? Yeah, no, I know it's not. It's a beautiful story. It's not exactly about this, but there was a priest in a little town called Mathura, which is just south of Vrindavan. And it was a Gopal temple. Gopal is baby Krishna. And this priest was a really cranky guy, an angry guy, and he never let children into the temple. He would chase them away. So he had been married a long time and he had no children himself. And Maharaji was in the area, and he came to see Maharaji, and he said, Baba, can you bless me with a child? And Maharaji looked at him and he said, how can that be? You prevent the children from coming to play with the child. How can you have one? Let the children come and play with him, the baby Krishna, in the temple, and you'll have your child. So he started to let the children come into the temple, and they had a kid in a year. I don't know. It's not exactly the same, but there's a simplicity about children, you know. A lot of people use the chanting with autistic kids and is like that, and they have amazing experiences. I've been invited a lot to sing with children, but I haven't been able to yet to meet with those kind of kids. But I get emails all the time about that. They just, you know, boom, you know, and they do a whole different thing.
When you're in a place like this, you know, the decibel level you
can... Earth?
Yeah, well, this environment.
Jeffrey Hall?
Not worried about how loud you're singing or whatever. But when you're in an urban flat or a space with neighbors, you have these... Does the decibel level have anything to do with it?
It just depends if you want to live, you know. If you don't want to live, just sing really loud. Your neighbors will kill you, you know. Sure, you know, everything has to be appropriate. I don't lay my trip on anybody. People are invited in. So if I'm in an apartment building, I don't sing at the top of my lungs, which is why I like to live alone in a quiet place so I can scream and yell and do all the stupid things I do. But it doesn't mean you can't sing and chant. It doesn't have to be loud. What has to be loud is your attention. That's all. It doesn't even have to be out loud, although it helps to move your lips and to breathe and say the words out loud because it helps you pay attention. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, of course, is that when we do this as a group and other people hear, they get blessings of the name. They hear the name, and even hearing the name is a great blessing. But in India, they understand that. Not in the West. They think you're crazy. And they call the police. So, unless you want to go to jail, quiet. You don't need to play a harmonium at 3 in the morning in an apartment building just to get off. It should be more inside. If you're in a 20,000 seat auditorium, you got to be loud. Like in Brazil, we sing outside in this Yoga for Peace Day in the park, right? There's like 20,000 people there. And it's so loud. And the speakers we're on a stage like this, but the speakers are about 40 feet high, like a rock concert. And you go like this, and it's like, ah. I like that.
Hi.
Hey.
So recently, an Indian teacher of mine who grew up in the West, she introduced to me the idea that there's essentially kind of two paths of bhakti going on in the world right now. And it's kind of this bhakti revolution, you could say, almost, and it seems like that in the last 5 years. But she said, you know, there's kind of this Western path of bhakti where we tend to intellectualize so many things. And exactly like you're saying, we go inside and we find what's inside. And then she kind of dropped this bomb on me the other day where she said, well, you know, there's that, but then there's also this more Eastern path of bhakti where we rely on the guru principle, and that it's not just a principle, but that there's this realized being who is alive, who is awake, who actually transfers his or her darshan to you, and that transfer of grace. So both of these paths, by the way, she's saying, are equally beautiful. There's no... they're not even, you know, exclusive of each other. They mix with each other, obviously. But what she was saying that was so interesting was that this more Eastern path, relying on the guru and having known a guru that is realized, it's kind of like hitting the accelerate button to finding love in this unconditional state. And so I guess my question is, A, do you agree with that? And B, if you do, why or why not?
You know, if there is an accelerate button, that's your karma to have that. So it's not really an accelerate button. I don't know anybody except an enlightened being who can judge where you're really at anyway. And certainly we can't judge. And if we think we're accelerating, it looks to me that that's just another thought. It's the same as thinking you're decelerating, right?
Yeah.
So with all due respect to your teacher, if it works for her, fine. But it has to feel right to you. And as far as, was she saying that she knows a particular guru that she's talking about?
That in general, just, well, I mean, she was...
No, let's hear it.
She was speaking of Amma.
Amma, okay. So if you feel devoted to Amma, that will certainly make you feel good. But it's not... To say that if you think that all the devotees of Amma are accelerated and you're not because you're not a devotee, that's not accurate.
I love it. Thank you.
Amma's great. She's a good guru. She does good things. She's one of the few gurus that you never hear anything bad about. When they clean out the cesspools of shit, she's the first one in there. Yeah. I wouldn't get in there. But she's the first one rolling up her sleeves, shoveling shit out of these holes. So she's a good one. There's no question about it. But that doesn't mean she's the only one, and it doesn't mean she's yours or you're hers. Everybody has their own thing going on. It's a big... Life is big. So whatever works for you, you have to find that. You have to feel it's right. And then you have to follow that. Nobody can tell you. And you can't manufacture love. You know. Love either happens or it doesn't. You're either sitting alone in Starbucks looking out the window hoping somebody's going to come by. Or you're not. It doesn't matter. It's going to happen or not happen. You can't make it happen. It's the same with devotion. You might think Amma's great. You might think she's really beautiful. But your heart's not moved in a certain kind of way, what are you going to do? Decelerate?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean you're decelerating. So there's no way of judging these things.
Yeah, I met her and it was amazing, it was beautiful, but I did not feel that type of
thing. First time I met Amma, she gave me a really big hug and she goes, Neem Karoli Baba, Neem Karoli Baba, Neem Karoli Baba. It was my guru, right?
Yeah.
So.
Thank you.
And then I used to go sing for her, especially in New York, when she came to New York. But the fighting for stage time to sing to her got so intense, I just said, forget about it, you know. What do I, let these people fight. They were ready to kill for 3 minutes to sing on the stage for her, you know. So I don't need to do that, you know, I'm happy, fine. It was an offering I was making. If it wasn't going to be accepted, they didn't want the offering, that was fine. So it's just weird, you know, what happens around gurus. In my day, we would kill if somebody got between me and Maharaja, you know. I would, you know, you know, like, you know, so that's just the way it is. You can't help it because all your shit comes out. When the love button is pushed, it becomes chaos, which is why we're so scared of love, because we become so vulnerable. You know, when your heart opens that way, it, as great as it is, it's just that scary to you.
I'm just really interested in your earlier influences.
I'm sorry?
I'm interested in your earlier influences.
Earlier influences.
Pre-Maharaji. Like, for example, I have a deep Jewish background. I had a choice to come between Rhythm and Jews this morning, singing with my sister, or come in here. So I do both.
Uh-huh.
And it works kind of nicely. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, you talk a lot about Maharaji and after, but what was your earliest influence? And has it the roots you talk about? Were the roots, do they come earlier? Or?
The first religious, spiritual stuff I got interested in was really Buddhism. I read this book when I was in high school that said, in Buddhism, your enlightenment is up to you. And I thought, wow, I like that. Because, you know, when you're 16, everybody's telling you what to do and what not to do. And here this was, it says, my enlightenment is up to me? That's fantastic. So I started getting interested in Buddhism at that point. And, of course, we're talking about the dark ages, you know. There were no gurus, there were no teachers coming around. There was no yogis in New York. There was a couple of them, but I never got the hit from any of them, especially. The first time I felt something which was beyond anything I had experienced was there was a yoga teacher named Swami Satchidananda in Integral Yoga in New York. And he was from the Shivananda lineage, Divine Life Society. And I had met him many times, and I liked him, but I didn't get a heart kind of hit from him, but I liked him. So I went to a weekend retreat with him, just outside of New York City. And there was another Swami there with him, who I didn't know who it was. And Satchidananda, Swami Satchidananda, gave his lecture. And at the end of his lectures, he would always go, Hari Om, like this, right? And I'd heard him so many times that when he stopped, finished the lecture, I was waiting for that Hari Om. But I had my eyes closed. I was sitting there. But all of a sudden, I heard, Shri Ram, Jaya Ram, Jaya Jaya Ram. And every cell in my body was having an orgasm. Even my toes. Everything just went, it felt like somebody plugged me into an electric socket. Every part of my body, I just went like this. And this other Swami was singing that. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know who he was, right? But it totally blasted me out in a way that completely beyond anything I had ever experienced. This was probably in 1968, 69. Move the clock ahead, 1972. I've been in India 2 years with Maharaji in the temple, a lot of that time. So one day, a car pulls up, and a bunch of Swamis get out of the car, and they walk into the ashram, over the bridge, right into Maharaji's room, which was unusual. I mean, they just walk right in. And I was standing outside the room, and I heard, Shri Ram, Jaya Ram, Jaya. And I went, what? That Swami who sang that was named Swami Chidananda, who was a great saint. He was the leader of Shivananda lineage after Shivananda. And he had known Maharaji for many, many years. And in fact, when Shivananda left the body, Maharaji was responsible for him being promoted kind of to the head of the... He made him take over as the thing. And they had known... So he had been singing to Maharaji before I met him. So when I heard him sing that, he had already been singing to Maharaji for years before that. So I was getting the thing like this, right? That was pretty interesting. Yeah. I didn't feel, and then again, I don't know if I had met Ram Dass yet at that point. I may have. When I met Ram Dass, you know who Ram Dass is?
Yeah, I saw One Giant Leap. That was my first experience.
Yeah. When I met him, this is when I realized that it's kind of a long story, but I went up to see him where he was living at his father's place in New Hampshire. And when I walked into the room where he was, without a word being spoken, I knew that whatever it was I was looking for was real. It existed. It was in the world. I could find it. This was a completely new feeling. Up to then, it was just books, you know. And books, you know, who knows? Anybody write? There's a lot of fiction out there. Even nonfiction is fiction a lot of times. So this was the first time that I really knew that whatever it is, it's real. That was a life-changing experience. If it wasn't that, I would have been a Buddhist monk. No question about it. And one time I was sitting with Maharaji, and he saw my one of my notebooks where we used to write out, you know, stuff from other books, Dharma stuff. There were no computers, so he has to have writing. Actually, was a thing. So he grabbed my book and he goes through it. And I had everything in there, Sufi stuff, Buddhist stuff, Hindu stuff, Christian stuff, everything. He goes through it, and he stops at this page. He says, what's this? And I look, and I went, oh, shit, it's Buddhist. This is Buddhist prayer. And I said, it's Buddhist. And I figure, I'm in a Hindu temple, you know, with my Hindu guru, and I got this Buddhist stuff, and he wants to know what it is, and I'm going to get bashed, you know. So he said, translate some. So I couldn't, but there was an Indian guy there who translated this prayer, part of this prayer. And then Maharaji stopped and he said, "Teek, right, correct." I looked at him like, what? Because it was this completely non-dual prayer. It was called the Song of Mahamudra, which is one of the highest Buddhist teachings. Completely non-dual. There's no devotion, nothing like that. It's all one, blah, blah, blah. And he said, it was right. I went, what? Then he kept going through the book, right? And there was a little picture of him. And he goes, who's that? I said, Baba, it's you. Nay, Buddha.
Thank you for listening to the Krishna Das Pilgrim Heart Hour. We really appreciate your support and hope you'll continue that support by going to mindpodnetwork.com/KD and clicking on the donate button or using our Amazon.com portal for all of your purchases. Thank you. Namaste.